Al, mate, great to have you here. Love what you're doing. I mean, a little bit of context really quickly. You run Brewgooder. It's the fastest growing independent beer company in 2023. You've had an unbelievable journey through non-profit and now into commerce and find a way to merge those two things together. How did you end up having dinner with George Clooney and Leonardo DiCaprio, guy from West Belfast, hanging out with these dudes?
Yeah, that's a great one. It's a bit of a long story.
We're here for it.
I was very, very fortunate that I had applied for lots and lots and lots of jobs in the charity sector and got rejected from absolutely every single one of them. Like literally some take, you know, immediate rejection. Others were a year in the making, which was quite tough. And I went for pints in Edinburgh, kind of to get my head shored a little bit. Met up with one of my best mates and his brother. We started playing ping pong, table tennis, whatever you want to call it, during the Edinburgh Festival. And he just started up this sort of cafe. And I guess the main hook of the cafe, or the main thing that got me really interested in it, was that it allowed people to go off the street and pay for a suspended food or coffee item for someone who was homeless or vulnerable. And I was just kind of blown away by this notion that you could actually like build a business that could do like really, really cool things for other people. And he kind of offered me a job on the spot. And part of me was like, I'm this, you know, University of Glasgow graduate. I've got all these ambitions to be like top civil servant, top international development guy. Like almost like part of my brain was saying, why do I want to go and work in a cafe? And then the other part of my brain was like, this is the most exciting thing you've heard in the past 5 years.
Interesting.
And whilst I did a little bit of barista work for them, whilst I did a little bit of, I guess like van driving, whenever the van driver was off, did a bit of social media. But the main thing was that within a couple of weeks, I was asked to take on this event called the Scottish Business Awards. And yeah, I was sort of hoisted into this position of doing, at the time, I think it was like a 1500 person event in Scotland, raising money for Social Bite, which was the cafe chain. And that had sort of developed into not just the suspended food and coffee items, but actually employing homeless people, people who were vulnerable, people who'd suffered from addiction, from all sorts of issues. And the whole premise of this event was, yes, to raise as much money as possible for the cause, but really to get the most influential people, the richest people, the most generous philanthropists in the room, you know, once a year. And there'd been some really cool speakers beforehand. There'd been like Bob Geldof. My first sort of foray into it was Sir Richard Branson, which was pretty cool. But then we were always kind of trying to build like the Glastonbury of business events in Scotland, which doesn't sound sexy, right? It doesn't really sound like something to dedicate your life to, but it was so exhilarating at the time. And the guy that I was working with, Josh, who was the founder of Social Bite, who had offered me the job, who kind of, I guess, believed in my ability as a 23, 24 year old to get stuck into this big event on my own, whilst he was building other aspects of the business. He sort of sat down one day and was just like, do you think we could get George Clooney to come? And I was like, I mean, I don't know, like how much.
I think I have him on WhatsApp. Let me just check.
Because he had a connection, and he said, he basically asked for how much it would take in essence. And the number came back, and I think it was close to like $500,000, but it was a donation to his charity. And this whole event was to raise money for charity. And we sort of looked at each other, and we looked at the previous like P&L of the event. And we're like, I don't know, we're going to have to make some big changes. We're going to have to charge more money for the tables. We're going to have to create a sort of range of tables that have access in a different way. So there's like a photo line opportunity.
Yeah.
One of them was, you know, you got to sit down and have lunch with George Clooney. And ultimately, we were going to bring him to Edinburgh to Social Bite, which he did, to meet the staff. And then to talk in front of what turned from in the first year, a 700 person event to a 1400 person event to a 2000 person event in Edinburgh, where, you know, we were selling tables and, you know, this was all above board because we were very, very clear when we were selling them that, like, you're not going to be able to see the stage. Like, you're going to have to watch this on a relay, on a screen.
Yeah.
And people were like, I just want to be in the room with George Clooney. And I swear to you, that man's charisma is nuts, right? Like, he's sitting in front of 2,000 people. And people can't see him, right? He's like a speck. You're only able to see some of, you know, on a screen. But I guarantee you, like, he had absolutely everybody thinking he was talking to them. Like, I've never seen, you know, he's a Hollywood star, right? There's a reason he's George Clooney. He's not just because he's a good looking dude and he's a good actor, but he has this charisma and this ability to remember people's names. And this is a bit of a sidebar story, but my mum and my sisters were over for the event. This is the first time they'd come to the event that I'd done. And they were all glitz and glam, and we got, you know, a photo taken with Rob Brydon, who was the host, and that was a great little sort of like champagne reception that we had. And my mum was kind of feeling quite ill because she's really invested, I guess, like any mum would be in my success, but she probably overdoes it a little bit. So she gets a bit stressed and then gets sick. And then she's not well. And on the day, you can tell she's not well. And I kind of just use this moment to sort of pull her out of the room and say, Mum, I need to tell you something. And she's really, you can see her sort of like getting flustered and panicking. She's like, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I think in her head, she's like, how can I help Alan, right? There's something's gone wrong and I can't help him. And I said, you're going to meet George Clooney.
Yo.
And she was like, just silence for a bit. And she goes, What would he have to say to me? What would he want to talk to me about? And I was like, I don't care. You're going to meet him. So we walked up the stairs, and like there's about two flights of stairs to get up to this room where the photo line is. And I mean, she is like, you can visibly see her shrink and debilitate. Like, and she's nervous, and I'm sort of like pulling her up the room. And then she gets into the space, and she can see him. And our whole thing is that Mum has loads of photos taken where she just doesn't smile. She covers her mouth. She sort of like almost doesn't want to be in the photo. And as soon as she sees him, like her face lights up, you know, we go over to him. And I think I'd met Clooney like briefly, you know, just at the start of the day. And somehow he remembered my name.
Crazy. So
he was like, oh, you must be Alan's mum. You look beautiful. Like, are you enjoying yourself tonight? In a way where it was like, it was almost like he prepared the lines in advance. Like, they were so good. So we get a photo, she's loving it. And yeah, that's kind of, I guess, how and the takeaways from meeting a kind of Hollywood celebrity that, yeah.
It's crazy to meet someone who, like, if they were a video game character, like their charisma points are just maxed out. And how shiny those people are. Like, it's strange. Like, until you have experienced it, it's very easy to be like, oh, like, why is everyone falling into the hype? Why is everyone falling into the hype? But like, even certain politicians, you know, who can go and shake like 100 hands in a row, and people walk away and they feel special.
And that's like, and there's like simple bits. Like, there's a book, I think it's Hard to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yeah,
and I think chapter two is basically like, you know, the most beautiful sound to everybody is their name. Right, like if you can remember their name. And I think there's like a Napoleon the second or third had this mad ability to like remember people's names, and that's why he was so just like diplomatically able to like smooth everybody. But that's a simple thing, right? But like the ability for him to have done that and just to on demand call that up just makes the whole thing really, really personable. And then whenever you're in front of 2,000 people, you think, well, it can't possibly carry to everyone in the room, but like it carried. Like it was almost like an aura or an atmosphere was literally pulsating from him.
Unbelievable. There's an interesting conversation to be had about charisma at scale.
Yeah.
We'll get into that. So yeah, today's part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where we interview really interesting people from Northern Ireland who have returned back home. That's why whenever you were out there, I was like, bro, I can't believe, like, because you just moved back to Northern Ireland when?
Yeah, in January. So what, amazing. 3 and a bit months strong. I'm yet to see a sunny day proper, but yeah.
It's coming, don't worry. It's coming. And NI Connections, they're the Diaspora Department of Invest NI. And so their mission is to connect the Northern Irish community around the world. And their big mission is to basically like provide resources and tools to help people move back home. So they've got resources like how to move you and your family back home after living overseas, how to move Northern Ireland for the first time, how to set up a business here, and hundreds of interviews and profiles featuring like the expat community. This place is insane. Like, this isn't part of the thing, but like, you ever heard of Neville Isdell?
No.
Mate, I have such an interview to send to you after this.
Please do.
So Neville is like born in Downpatrick, moved to South Africa pretty young, ends up at age, I think 60 or 65, global CEO of Coca-Cola.
That's nuts.
Isn't that nuts? Yeah. And I'm like, he's 15 minutes down the road from us.
That's some journey. Like,
so we love this series because it's kind of like, we often joke, it's like a little bit like a treasure hunt where it's like, what Northern Irish people can we find all around the world?
There's definitely going to be like a 6 degrees of separation, like Kevin Bacon scenario going on that you could probably connect to, like literally within two steps, you can get to Coca-Cola, the CEO.
100%, 100%. So yeah, look, niconnections.com is where you can sign up to their free email newsletter. They pump out some really, really interesting content around, like we said, Northern Irish people living overseas. And if you are considering moving to Northern Ireland for the first time or to return back home again, it's the place to check out. So we love doing this series. We love sitting down with guys like Alan, who have gone on their own hero's journey, their own returner's journey. So West Belfast, what was your home life like growing up? What was your childhood like? And specifically, where does this deep and very clear desire to serve come from?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing to say, and this is not to solicit pity or sympathy or anything like that, it's kind of just to set the scene, is that like when I was younger, you know, 1.5, my dad passed away during the Troubles. And on one hand, like there's a loss thing there, right? There's no question. But on the other hand, there was a massive gain, I think, in my life as well. I had two older sisters who were 12 and 16 years older than me. I had my mum. And I basically then, I think overnight almost in that scenario, went to having three mums.
Right.
And like having one mum is good enough, right? Like if you've got a really, you know, loving mother, I'm sure it's not everyone has that. But when you do, it's a very valuable thing. But when you have effectively, you know, that squared, right, or more with three, and who play different roles in your life, you know, you ultimately grow up in an environment where every single day you're told how much you're valued, how much you're loved. That, you know, and this is the thing that I think always kind of sticks with me, is that I was always told I was the best, but not, the inference wasn't that I was better than anybody else. It was almost like if you understand, like the nowadays parlance would be like, you're enough.
Right.
And I think that was like drilled into me, that whatever I wanted to do, whatever I wanted to be, was amazing. Right. Whether it was become, you know, global CEO of Coca-Cola or it was just, you know, sit and paint all day and not even exhibit your work. You know what I mean? Like whatever path I chose to do would be good enough for them. And I think that that was something that almost kind of like sets a bit of a, I wouldn't say sets a fire in you, but gives you a level of self-belief and confidence that some things are going to work out for you. And then I guess growing up in West Belfast, you know, I loved it. I played football, you know, every day out in the street. I grew up with friends, with, you know, older, their brothers, et cetera, et cetera. I have a cousin who is still a big part of my life, I guess, in terms of, you know, I didn't have any brothers when I was growing up, and he was born prematurely, and you know, we were almost, he was about 4 years older than me, but we grew up together to a certain extent where we were probably like, I guess, the same age and, you know, mentally and stuff like that, which was great. And he inspired me to be an Arsenal fan, and I just loved him. And he just had this social EQ, which was just, you know, phenomenal. And I always felt like I was growing up with people to look up to and people to be encouraged by. And then whenever I was 11, mum decided, and, you know, at the time I was furious with her because I was leaving all my friends behind and that. But when I was going to secondary school, she wanted me to go to Ballycastle, up the road, obviously, just about an hour. And that took me into an environment which was very, very different from West Belfast, for sure. You know, I grew up in the Glen Road. You know, I would be surrounded, I guess, by, like, you know, I'd say politics was very, very, very present. Like, you know, I even remember stuff like the Good Friday Agreement day and someone coming out onto the street and saying it's yes or, you know, whatever. And I remember just, you know, even seeing, you know, the army on the streets doing sort of patrols and stuff. But I never thought that was, you know, that was something, I guess if you told that to somebody in England or Wales or Scotland, they'd be like, what? But it was kind of just, it kind of felt a little bit normal to
me. The classic is, it's like you're going into like a mall or you're on a bus and someone knew there's announcements like, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, there's a bomb scare. We have to, and all Northern Irish people are like, oh, for Christ's sake. And all the Scottish people are like, clutching onto their loved ones. Do you know what I mean? And we're like, oh, what a major inconvenience.
But that was like the ambient conditions of, you know, the first 8 to 10 to 12 years of my life. But it was like somebody's entire 30 years of, you know, growing up.
Yeah, right?
You just had this ambient level of like, I guess, you know, I don't know if I can swear on the podcast, but kind of like fucked upness, right?
Sure.
Like where you're not able to really fully have the life that you want because, you know, of obvious reasons. But I was brought to Ballycastle, went to school in Carnlough and Garantar, which, you know, just give me the best drive to school, the best bus journey to school, I think, in the world. Like it went all the way, snaked all the way down the coast. And I just loved school. I loved my mates. And I didn't really have any particular drive. You know, a lot of my friends, like still my friends at school, my friends now, you know, they were almost like set that they wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant or whatever at a very early age. And they started like, I guess, shaping their subjects in school around what they wanted to be as a person. And I never really thought, and I still think as a 33-year-old, like I don't really know what I want to be, if that makes sense. So I just kind of like made it up on the fly. So my A-level subjects and stuff were like, you know, philosophy and business studies and IT and history. Like there's no outcome there, right?
Yeah.
And then whenever I went to look for uni places, I just wanted to study politics. Like I didn't want to be a politician. Certainly, you know, it's a dirty word these days. And I think it does get a bad rep. And I think there are people who have made major change without being politicians, but have been in politics. But for me, it was just about like, why is there conflict? Like my life had been affected by conflict and why is this and how do we get past it? Or what ideas are empowering for people? And then to choose my university, the actual university, like everyone like looks at UCAS and stuff and that's fine. But my guide was the NME, you know, the music magazine, New Music
Express, which
is probably defunct now, to be honest. But I was, you know, a little country bumpkin by the time I was 17. And I was getting this magazine about indie music every Tuesday. I'm paying pretty handsomely for it now when you think about how they probably give it away at tube stations if it's still going. And I would flick to the back and I would see all the bands that I wanted to see were never playing in Belfast. They were always playing in London, Manchester and Glasgow. And London just seemed like it would be too big. I would get lost there and it just wouldn't be what I'd love to do. Manchester, as growing up as an Arsenal fan, I thought, I just couldn't be surrounded by United fans. Like genuinely, like that was a big part of the rationale. And now I think it would be, I don't want to be surrounded by Man City fans. So I'm glad I never went and stayed.
The double-edged sword.
Yeah, exactly. You can't win, literally. And then I looked at Glasgow and I thought, you know what, it's kind of similar to Belfast, right? Like for good and for bad reasons. It's a short flight away. It's a boat away. If I ever got homesick, I could come back. And yeah, I just kind of decided to go to Scotland and it was a pretty transformative experience. I went to university. I loved it. I had a great degree. I had great friends. But I didn't really have anything on my CV in many respects. And this is where it kind of like comes into the question of like, how did the Brugger stuff kind of emerge? I think this is kind of where it gets, everything starts to come in together.
Right. All those like different mini side quests that you've been building up, philosophy, politics.
Exactly.
You know, how that all merges together. What was it like? It's hard to leave home, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to leave a mum behind.
Yeah.
It's especially hard to leave three mums behind.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you must have been pretty compelled to leave. Like I left at 18 as well. Like I left mom and two sisters behind and like it's a big step.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thing, like compelled, like was there something subconsciously or consciously driving me to newer places? I felt like uni should be an adventure to a certain extent, mm-hmm. That you should, but almost like an adventure within boundaries, right? Like I could, you know, I didn't go to London. That would be too much.
Right.
So for me, I wanted to like kind of just be in a place where I could be myself within a relative degree of comfort. And I felt like that was a nice place to do it. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I remember the night before leaving, like me and my mum basically just didn't speak because it was almost like this rift. We didn't speak, not because we were angry at each other, just because there was like a massive amount of emotion of like, right, this is the end of it.
Whoever speaks first is going to burst into tears.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't want to prod my mum to like, you know, speak because she was visibly on that yeah, cusp for obvious reasons. And then the thing was, she was also going away that next day. So actually I had to go to Scotland by myself on the boat and on the train and then to Murano Street where I was the first of my house. So I arrived in this, you know, effectively prison. I think the people who made our student accommodation were the same people who made like the prisons, like the
legends.
People. Yeah. And it was exactly like that, maybe a bit better bedclothes or a bit better furnishings, but it was just this little cell. And I remember thinking, wow, like I've taken a big, you know, leap off the edge for me, for an 18-year-old,
100%. You know. But like, and, you know, Daniel here, like we were at a wedding last week, and Daniel was shooting it. One of my best mates got married. And even just like, you know, that experience, taking a flight by yourself, yeah, taking a bus by yourself, like those are, like they're big moments. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it was probably like this little sort of like bushy-eyed, like,
of course, oh, you know, yeah. You're Frodo leaving the shower.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? You
exactly,
really are.
Yeah, and I was going on and I didn't know who I might meet. And luckily for me, there was other people going to, you know, some of my best friends were going to Glasgow, but they were going to Strathclyde and Cali, and I was going to University of Glasgow. And you're in the same city, but you're not, right? Like literally in this case of University of Glasgow, you're in the West End, right? It's almost like a little town in and of itself. And I remember like the first week, just even signing up for stuff, right? Like just like, I have to go to this to sign up for this lecture, and I have to put this, and I have to go to see my advisor of studies. And the good thing was that my pal Michael was with me. And I said to him like a couple of years later, I was like, do you know, if you weren't there, I probably would have like dropped out.
Wow.
Like, I felt that like, not, I wouldn't say alone, but I just felt that like out of my depth, that I was like, actually, this is quite challenging.
Yeah.
And then I didn't really feel that again until I was leaving uni, mm-hmm, actually, when stuff had to become real again. Like there was almost like a next level of real, like the boss, you kind of like...
Bro, every time you level up, the boss gets bigger.
Exactly, right?
It definitely does.
So I'm getting to the end of uni and I'm thinking, I love this. This is amazing. I've got so many stories. I've got so many good friends and I've just got so many things that I feel like have set me up, you know, for just life. And then there's this moment where you go, but then I have to start doing the life bit. And I look at it and go, I don't have anything on my CV, mm-hmm, right? I had a girlfriend at the time who said, like, almost like in a flippant way, she was like, you're so lucky, you know, you can do anything you want. Like, you know, or it was the way she said it was almost like, you know, you have no plan. Mm. And I think she meant it positively. Mm-hmm. But in my head, I was like, oh shit, I've got no plan, right? So what am I going to do? So then I think, right, the best way I can do stuff that interests me. So I started writing for a sort of student journalism blog about football. I became the Partick Thistle correspondent for it, went to games home and away, absolutely loved that. But I didn't know if I really wanted to do journalism. And then I started applying for like volunteering positions. And I guess the reason for that was probably just because my mum had always given up her time for like other people in many respects, and she never would have broadcast it as that, but the subliminal message was, if you've got talents and you've got time, like use it for like good, right? I mean,
yeah,
she was looking after, you know, kids with severe disabilities, for example, when it came to like respite care and that sort of thing. And I just thought, well, maybe this is something that I could, you know, I see the value in, so I might as well do it. So I decided to go to Nepal. We did a sort of student volunteering program, sort of like half education, half sort of female based empowerment around girls and teaching them. And in this rural part of Nepal, which was an amazing 3 months. And when you go out there, you get all these injections, and I like faint genuinely if I get like a finger prick blood test. Like, I don't like blood and I don't like needles. And I'm getting these like massive injections for Japanese encephalitis, right? Where you're like, if you get this, you will like, you will be in bad shape, rabies, all this sort of stuff. And you have to pay for it. And I'm like, oh my God, like, what am I doing?
Bro, they're so expensive.
Yeah, they are.
At that stage of your life, especially, you're like, exactly. Oh, I'm dropping like 300 quid on jabs.
And that's just to get on the plane, yeah. Right? But the one piece of advice they tell you for free is just don't drink water that you can't like crack the top off, that you can't boil to make sure there's nothing in it. And I obviously didn't take that advice because I ended up taking some, you know, effectively on building sites and various different things, some contaminated water. And I started to get a wee bit ill. There was a few things that weren't working, but I just kind of put it down to like Delhi belly being away. And then by the end of the trip, I was kind of, I'm not a big guy, but I lost a lot of weight and things just were not working. And I know podcasts don't technically have watersheds, but I'll not get into it. Had to do some really grim tests. And then it turns out that I had a parasite.
Oh.
And for me, that was the first sort of moment of like vocational calling, if you like. They basically said, you've lived your entire life, right? You've been loved and encouraged and you've had endless possibilities and there's been this open road for you. But there were people born the exact same day as you who never made it past like your collective fifth birthday. And it's not because they didn't have the same talents, the same familial love even. It's because they lacked something that was so basic.
Mm.
So for me, that kind of put me in this position of saying, I'm going to try and break into a space where I can dedicate my career. Mm-hmm. This concept of 80,000 hours, like how can you dedicate something if you're not going to found a business, if you're not going to, you know, give money away, like can you actually use your talents? So I decided to apply for every single international development job going and got rejected from every single one.
Wow. So it was getting sick that gave you the context and the perspective that they made, here, mate, this is actually something that's worth throwing my weight behind.
Yeah, I think experience wasn't the sickness, because the sickness wasn't bad. It wasn't pleasant, but it wasn't bad. It wasn't life-threatening. But it was this sort of almost this sort of first blocker in the way of saying, or not a blocker. It was the first mirror that was held up to say, your life's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
You've had an unending stream of upward mobility. You know, you can do what you want. You've been encouraged to do what you want. But you're lucky because there's more people than you can imagine that haven't. And it's not their fault. Right. Mm. They just happen to be an accident of birth that they don't have the exact same opportunity as you do. So that kind of it's not like that was a light bulb moment where I'm like, right, I'm going to set up a beer company that then does clean water. Right. That was a different journey. And that's a journey we can tackle next. But it was definitely something to say, come on, man, like give something, not necessarily give something back, but like pay something forward, give yourself a meaningful career. And that sort of intersects with something which is probably ambient in my own life, where, you know, my dad passed away when he was 40, right? And I kind of think that I operate on this basis of saying, like, leave it all on the field by the time I'm 40. And then by the time I'm 40, not that I'll turn into a terrible person, but if I want to do something else, I can do something else.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I can put the first half of my career, for example, into something that is pretty meaningful and leaves a legacy, then that all those sort of autobiographical factors and pure luck, right? I got very lucky in my first career break. I still am very, very lucky to this day in Brugger, but those types of things have all compounded into like a constellation, if you like, of why I'm here, why we're here today.
Yeah. Awesome. I've heard Neville Isdell, Coke guy.
Mm-hmm.
He did a great podcast on another show called 3 Points by People Playbook, all about integrity.
Mm.
And his take on corporate social responsibility, it's really always stuck with me. He's got quite a strong opinion on it. He basically says, like, if the cause isn't connected to your business, stay away from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he says, from what he did at Coke, he realized that, like, look, we use a lot of water.
Yeah.
And we also disrupt mm-hmm. a lot of the natural water mm-hmm. cycles and stuff mm-hmm. whenever we move into countries. So we should throw as much as our weight possible to not only rectify the harm that mm-hmm. we cause or potentially cause,
yeah.
but also make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, you know, you can, like, look for the stars aligning and, like, and conspiracy, like, way too much. But it's so interesting that, like, one of your kind of origin moments was contaminated water.
Yeah.
And now you run a beer company?
Yes.
That literally, like, is doing good. It's in the name.
Yeah. So, yeah, like, I think it's interesting. There's multiple different, you know, justifications about why we do what we do. And just to recap, you know, we have the Brugger business, and for every single pint, bottle, can, four pack, whatever we sell, we contribute to our foundation, which then does effectively people oriented work for communities to effectively just to brew a kind of a fairer world.
Yep.
That's kind of our operating, you know. But in essence, you know, you could also go back and say, well, water, so we do a lot in water for those obvious biographical reasons from my perspective. But, you know, brewing started in many ways in the West because water was not safe enough to drink, right? So
sure.
there's this circularness to it. Then there's this notion where you're saying, right, well, we're taking a quite a water intensive, you know, we probably operate on 4 pints to every pint water to beer. But then we're unlocking, you know, 10 times that on in projects. So there's almost this, like, sort of balancing act that we're doing.
Sure.
And minimizing the footprint is definitely something we want to do as much as we want to do the maximizing thing. But even that is like that's not the reason, you know, the symmetry of it is not the reason I started it. The reason I started it was when I went from per student to per graduate, I started spending money on two things. One of them was coffee, which I still do. And the other one was beer, right? I started trading into, you know, all these amazing craft breweries from the States, from all around the UK, from down the road, like stouts and sour beers and IPAs and 10% beers and all this sort of stuff. And all my pals were kind of like enthralled in this boom time for this industry. So we would plan our nights around where did the most interesting beer.
Nice.
And that was the subject of the conversation. So it's Brugger is an idiosyncratic thing. It's like, I had the water experience, I had the social bite experience, and I quite like beer. And I just decided, right, well, let's just jam those things together.
Yeah, yeah,
do
yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But actually it's a really interesting industry to be in because it's very dynamic. You know, there was low barriers to entry. And we've done really well despite everything, but I wouldn't have done it just to start a beer company. Like, I certainly would not have done that. And that's not anything against beer. That's more just because I just felt like there was a moment or an opening where I could express myself and all these things in something that I could at least be sustained about being an interesting day-to-day thing. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, well, what is it about beer that's actually quite a powerful thing? And for me, it's like, it's the heart of, like, social occasions.
Yeah.
And whether it's alcohol-free beer, whether it's alcohol beer, you know, it's never here or there. You meet up in the pub to have a pint with someone, to catch up, to commiserate, to celebrate, you know, to watch the football, to watch the sport, to watch the rugby. And even in the most, like, masculine cultures where people don't talk about their feelings or, you know, maybe that's not what they do, you still have this scenario where somebody goes and buys a beer for somebody in a round, and there's an implicit thing there which says, I trust you, or, you know, small L, love you enough to give you this, with the understanding that at some point down the line you'll also want to reciprocate that. And I think that that's such a powerful social, I don't think there's any other category
mm-hmm.
from a consumer goods point of view other than maybe coffee, but I don't think it's the same thing, where you have this inherent social power within it
mm-hmm.
and all you need to do is use it in a more explicit way to make, like, pretty cool things happen for people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think the comparisons between coffee and beer are really interesting, and the contrasts, I should say. And I love how you're interested in both. I guess, like, barista batter doesn't have the same ring to it as brewer gooder.
You could use brew. I think that's the beauty of it. You could almost use brew.
Oh,
in
this
both
could be
ways,
a few years down the line.
The side hustle.
Interesting. But for me, like, even if you like, I'm really, really interested in like male on male communication and men's mental health and how men open up. And if you think about even the dynamics of a coffee shop, it's a little bit more like this, where it's like sitting in front of each other, whereas the pub is more side to side.
Yeah.
And like men communicate way better side to side when there's less eye to eye contact.
100%.
We were talking about Blind Boy before recording. Mm-hmm. He has an amazing short story called like something Gruyere in the Desmond.
Gruyere in the Desmond,
That short story haunts me.
It's very powerful.
And it's all about men's mental health and them in the pub and then like focusing on something that allows them to communicate something else. So in that story, it's the cheese and it's the beer.
Yeah, and I think that's it, right? It's almost like, it's like football, right? Like you talk about a certain thing that's exterior to your own relationship, say, for example, where there's almost like a common frame of reference that makes it easier to talk about your emotions or whatever. And I think with beer, it's almost like, especially in that craft beer boom, which is basically referred to in that short story, is like you can almost say like I have a real interest in this one thing and I can show like I'm in the know, or you know, I can recommend something and someone will go, oh, that's delicious, and it's a reflection back on you, right? So there's almost like this game that we're all playing where you know something that's exterior to us actually helps us bond, you know, on a very, very,
it's kind of like, it is a weird comparison, but like, you know, like football cards and football stickers where it's like, look which one I
shiny,
find.
Yeah,
oh, amazing. Oh, that's a rare one.
Player,
or like Pokemon cards, something like that. Interesting, man. I'm really fascinated by that actually. Cause there is, you know, and if you think about like Irish culture and Irish tradition as well.
Yeah.
It's like the, what did someone say to me one time? Basically how like the bar became like the modern church. It was like the community place.
Yeah,
Macklemore, this is just going way out there now. Macklemore's got an interesting song called Neon Cathedrals, where he talks about basically how like the bars become the church and it's where people congregate and like the bartender is the priest and so many rich stuff in there.
And I think what's amazing, like, I mean, it's probably just a sign of where I am in my drinking journey as well as my life journey. But like when you go for a Guinness, I think, and this is not a advert for Guinness despite what I'm about to say, is basically like there's almost a repository. I don't know if this is too intellectualizing it, but like a repository of like stories within the pint, if that makes sense.
There is, mate.
Like you're almost doing something which is like a tradition, which is more than just the going for the pint. It's like you're in a long lineage of people who've went and done the same thing and talked, and the ritual of, you know, something being poured slowly and you know, that first big gulp and all that sort of stuff. It's like, there's like, there is a sort of secular religion around it.
There definitely is.
And it's accessible. That you don't need to have that's the one thing I thought about craft beer, which was, and we don't call ourselves a craft beer brand anymore. We call ourselves an impact brand in the beer category, which I think is something we can get on to. But, you know, I don't like to go anywhere now where I have to feel like I will have to work hard just to order the beer, whereas when you go to a pub with your friends or your family and you've got that go-to, whether it's a lager, whether it's a, you know, a stout or whatever, it's almost just like all the barriers get lowered to actually just having a good time as well. And that's the only thing about craft beer, I think, that even I was probably partaking in it at the start, where there was a lot of gatekeeping. And I sort of almost felt like, even though I've got a beard and I'm a, you know, young guy who's, you know, had an office job, even I felt kind of like still on the periphery of all the knowledge and all that, which I don't feel now.
Sure. And I mean, it's kind of like super hipster coffee. Yeah. Where, you know, you feel like you're ordering like a 2 gram bottle of wine.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? And it's just this whole thing. And
yeah,
you're like,
they
oh.
should bring out like the little taster so you taste it and you go like, I'll have that sort of thing. And they pour the rest of it in.
So how do you straddle those two things? How do you straddle kind of appeasing to the connoisseur market with appeasing to like the general consumer?
Yeah, I actually don't think we do appeal to, I mean, I don't think anyone.
Who drinks brew gooder? Brew gooder. Tell me that.
I think, like, I mean, if I could answer that, would be far further on. We think we have a hunch, right? There's the people we Target, and then there's the people that actually drink it. But in the main, they're younger, they want more accessible, taste-driven products that effectively make them, that their drink choices or their brand choices say something about them. And obviously we've got, you know, we look different from the rest of the craft beer brands that we compete against. We're a bit more toned back, a bit more retro into sort of modern look. But we make accessible beers. That most of our beers are between 4% and 4.8%. And actually our most successful beers are 4.3% Session IPA. And they just want uncomplicated quality in that sense. But I think they want to associate themselves, whether it's that flex or whether that's, you know, I drink this beer, this says this about me, about the ethics and the sustainability angle behind it. And yeah, they're younger, they're more diverse. Like all the data that we get back, and you know, we're trying to build the company on insight, mm-hmm. almost reaffirms what we're trying to go over. We call them the purposeful progressives, right?
Yeah.
People who, you know, aren't prepared to sacrifice on any of the reasons why you would consume any product. So taste, quality, price, all that sort of stuff. But then they want that sort of almost cherry on top that we kind of give them.
Yeah. It's like if I'm buying a product anyway, mm-hmm. I may as well buy one that at least does some good. You know, kind of like the Tom's idea, yeah. and very similar things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think the ones that we look at actually are probably three brands, probably Patagonia, which is known by a significant amount of people for the environmental aspect of, you know, we're in business to save planet Earth.
But you buy them because the quality is just
quality,
insane.
It's cool, you know, it's pretty effortless, it's probably status symbol about mm-hmm. it. Then you've got the likes of Tony's Chocolate Only, which is just a fun brand with delicious chocolate.
Yeah.
And in the wrapper, it'll tell you what it needs to tell you about its anti-slavery work. And then you've got Ben & Jerry's, which I think is our closest comparison, which is just a brand that exists to do good things in the world for people, but is playing in a really fun category like ice cream, where it can be silly and throw away, but it can also be serious. And ultimately, we kind of think that we just want to be a beer brand that does really cool things that beer brands do.
Yeah.
But actually, if you scratch away at the surface and you go down the rabbit hole, you'll see that like the pint that you're drinking ends up making something really, really cool for people.
Yeah.
And that's increasingly at home and abroad. Yeah. And that will only grow, I guess, the more people buy into that journey. But to win them over, we need to have quality,
sure,
look good, feel cool in your hand, and be reasonably priced, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
can't be asking too much. And I think we're making really good progress on that. Like, we win quality awards all the time, and we call it beer washing now. Do you know the way you've got greenwashing, where people try to be more like Brugger in the beer space by greenwashing? And then we're like, no, we need to tell people that the beer's good and
right.
that you're not making a sacrifice. And I think that's kind of, once you taste the beer, you kind of think, okay, yeah, they've got that. But it's actually convincing that drinker who might go, well, if I'm being asked to make some sort of charitable contribution, then I'm probably making a sacrifice.
Right.
And that's a mindset we need to shift.
It's a cherry on top thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's really cool. Man, I'm like, I'm just speaking into existence an alcohol-free Ben & Jerry's beer collab.
Yeah. Listen, you put it out there. We'd love to work with those guys for sure. We'd love to work with any of the people that we just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think it's necessarily beyond the realms of possibility. You know, we were included in B Corp sort of top 5% of companies for our community work. And actually, if you look at our peers in that group, they were Patagonia, Tony's, Ben & Jerry's. And you're like, oh, little Brugger is in the same space as that. And it gives you a reason to chat to them.
Well, once you've met George Clooney, the whole world becomes so possible. I'm kind of joking, but I'm also kind of not. It's like when you have enough experiences like that in your life, where you, like, you come up with a crazy idea, mm-hmm. or you have a vision, and then you actually see that vision come to pass. Like, we kind of joked earlier about like life being like a video game. Every time you level up, the boss is bigger. It's like every boss that you knock down, you're like, yeah, I could probably have a crack at the next one.
Yeah, and there is an element of that where I'm a big fan of doing like almost like gratitude journaling type thing. I try to do it every day, but it maybe doesn't work out like that. And one of the best things is just like a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, like what was your worry then that isn't your worry anymore?
Class.
And you realize, wow, wow, I've done like really cool stuff.
Yeah.
Genuinely, even if it all ended today, like I could, like even if I was forced into retirement, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was the equivalent of a big leg break for a footballer or whatever. Like I would still be like, I've had a decent career.
Yeah,
but I also had a great apprenticeship, right? So the person that I probably haven't spoken about in terms of like a massive influence in me was Josh. Like he trusted me with a massive event to basically run it, and if it had any problems, come and ask him some questions, but just to run it as I saw fit and to build it and whatever. But I worked side by side on him with projects like Sleep in the Park, where we got people to like sleep outside in -7 in Edinburgh under, you know, 9,000 people under Edinburgh Castle to basically call for a change in the Scottish government and their housing policy to build villages, literally villages in Edinburgh for homeless and vulnerable people. But that wasn't every, I worked with him for what, probably about 6 years, and nothing seemed impossible with him.
Right.
He said something one day, like, and I know it sounds a bit cheesy and a bit almost apocryphal, but I'm probably going to butcher it, but it was basically like, yeah, if you think big, like big things will happen. Almost like if you think really big, a medium big will happen.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then he just made small bets every single time, every single time, every single time. And we worked so hard to make amazing things that a year previous weren't even possible.
Yeah.
You know, going from Branson to Clooney, Clooney to DiCaprio for those things. But then putting on big concerts where people were literally choosing to be, you know, effectively homeless for the night in order to lend their voice to people who didn't really have a voice. And all the way through that journey, you almost just saw like that self-belief that he had almost rubs off on you to say, well, if this guy trusts me and I can see what this guy's doing, mm-hmm. then I should trust myself. And then after, it doesn't become conscious, it's just in you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
100%.
And then when you get, I think like there's like a yin and a yang element to this. So there's the self-belief that you have in yourself because of other people trusting you or reaffirming you or whatever. But then there's the flip side of that, which is the underestimation. When people tell me that I can't do something, I go, I understand why you're saying that because you can't see what I see in my head, right? And I don't blame you for that, but I'm going to prove you wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we get underestimated day and daily as a business or as a person. But if you understand the top bit of that, the self-belief being the fire, like this, almost this layer of doubt becomes the accelerant, and then it just starts to build out and create its own momentum, which is
so good, man. As we start to kind of land the plane, there's kind of one thing that I want to square off, and it's something that you said at the very, very start. Mm-hmm. So you said you were wrestling like in your head, do I go off and become a top civil servant, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera? Or do I follow, now you said head, I'm going to say the heart. Mm-hmm. I know for me, like a big part of my journey has been squaring off business and making money, mm-hmm. and making an impact in the world. Because mm-hmm. I, like you, left home at 18. I went to work with homelessness. I actually also did a trip in Nepal, like did earthquake relief stuff in Haiti. Like, you know, and I was like, this is going to be my life. I'm going to be a traveling nomad, yeah. documentary maker type, Nat Geo, nonprofit, social impact sort of guy. Yeah. And it was very, very difficult for me to transition from that into like podcasting and like mm-hmm. a very like commercially, especially now, orientated mm-hmm. business mm-hmm. where I feel like I found my thing, telling stories, drawing the stories out of other people.
Yeah.
We've connected that with big vision and purpose for Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. We've connected with vision for around the world. How do we help purpose-driven people share stories?
Yeah.
How have you squared that off? Because I do think it's slightly a Northern Irishism where we look at like money as evil and like charity, nonprofit being like angelic.
Yeah. So it's interesting, right? So one version of me, a younger version of me, thought that the only way to do the thing that you wanted to do was the civil service way, right? Because I didn't have enough experience to know that it wasn't. And it was only that somebody was doing something that I thought was cool for other people in a radically different way with Social Bite in the cafes. That I was like, oh, wow, there's actually like, you know, there's a scales from eyes moment where actually there's more possibilities. But I guess like the best thing that ever happened was getting rejected from that, because that's not who I am. I'm a very, I want to say small C creative person where I just love coming up with ideas that get over certain problems. But I can't get away from the fact that, like, I set the business up and the foundation up, and the foundation's a shareholder in the company, in order to make sure that the most amount of scale I could get in my business also by default meant the scale and the impact work that we're doing. And, you know, we're into the 140,000 people plus impact being created through the Brugger Foundation. At least that's our best estimates that we can work out on the basis of all the projects that we've done. But my sort of co-founder, James, always says to me, like, you started up a beer company to fund a charity. Like, why didn't you just set up a charity? And there's something in my mind where the crossover of what is amazing about Brugger as an impact business is that it gives you all the amazing benefits of starting and growing a company, but also doing the thing alongside that actually makes your, like, you know, that's the fuel that gets you past the really hard days. And yes, I've had to go from naive guy who at the start was giving away all of our profits, right, which is just not sustainable, to the guy who had to make some pretty hard decisions around, right, actually we're going to define contribution this model so that actually we might lose money for a bit, but we can grow and we can, you know, and that's been proven right by the impact that we're making. But it's still exploring the space in between the making money and the angelic side. But there's huge scope for personal, you know, fulfillment, you know, trying new stuff, that actually I think if people understood that there was that third space, that actually they would get a lot of satisfaction out of building their business and doing something that was important. But to your point around Neville, it has to be intrinsic to the business, right? If we started a business that was just completely unrelated to, you know, the impact that we wanted to make, then it's a house of cards, right? It'll fall very, very quickly. And I think that's the beauty of Brugger, is that a certain amount of factors make sense for it to still be here 8 years on and actually in much better shape.
Unreal. Why'd you move home?
So me and a long-term partner split up. That was probably the start of that. But I think why I moved home was probably a notion that I was a bit uprooted, let's say, not in a bad way, right? Like, just, I felt like there was nothing actually tying me down. And one of the first things I did was live in Cape Town for a month and, you know, stay with some friends and whatever. But I felt like I wanted to come home because I really valued the fact that I could spend time with my family. I have three nieces. One of them's, you know, just turned two, and I get to see them three times a week, right? Minimum. And there's days where I see my whole family, like, even if it's just fleetingly, like my sister's picking up her daughter and she's just driving by me and, like, oh, sorry, I need to go. And I write that down at the end of the day and say, I've done a cool stuff in work and I went to the gym and I've done all this, you know, the optimizing my life stuff, but I've also just seen my family.
Right.
And my mum's 71 now, and she'll live on, don't get me wrong when I say this, but there's probably a limited amount of quality time left. And if I, in 2 years' time, settle down, have kids, whatever looks like, whatever life throws up, or I have to move away somewhere or whatever, I might not get that chance again. And coming back to Belfast has been the softest landing ever, because people are sound. Like, people are salt of the earth people. I've found a great gym. I've found a great community around that. I've connected with friends that I've lost contact with, some that I've had a bit more contact, and I get to be rooted in a place where every day I get to see people who I love and love me.
What's like an absolutely quintessential thing that you can only do in Northern Ireland that brings you a lot of joy? Because it's like, you know, the crisps never taste better.
Yeah,
the accent never sounds sweeter. The grass never looks greener until the day that you actually leave. So I love the perspective of returners.
I think the best thing about coming back is that everyone, it's not difficult to start a conversation. Like, I go to a gym near where my mum is, and I feel like I've known these people for years, but if you work it out, I've probably only spoke to any one of them for a maximum of 2.5 minutes. Right? Like, do you know what I mean? But every conversation is, all right, mate, and, you know, you're doing well, that's great. I heard that thing the other day, blah, blah, or, you know, you get to encourage somebody else. And even in me impersonating that voice, like, I notice when I come back, and my sister said it the other day, like, you speak like you're from Belfast again, right? Like, you don't even speak like you're from Ballycastle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you certainly don't speak like you've lived in Scotland for a while. Like, it's that notion where you actually start up these conversations and everyone's kind of in one way or another sort of just, I don't know how to, it's ineffable, right? It's like people are just sound and they're salt of the earth people. That's what I've missed and that's what I've loved reconnecting with.
Something in the water.
There is.
There definitely
is. Or the tears.
Oh man, I've enjoyed this like thoroughly, genuinely. I love being able to scratch like little things that are like personally interesting to me. Yeah. And I think what you're doing with Brewgooder is unbelievable. And I think that the message of you can have an impact in a commercial marketplace. Mm. And there's an argument to be made that sometimes you actually have more opportunities to make an even bigger impact. I think it's really, really inspiring. And I think if I had listened to this conversation when I was 18, it would have given me a lot of good food for thought and maybe would have shortcutted the video game levels a little bit faster, some of them. What advice would you give, kind of closing question, for an 18-year-old? If you could go back in time to yourself?
Yeah, I think the biggest commodity, or hopefully the biggest commodity you have as an 18-year-old is time. And I mean that in two ways. I mean, you have the most amount of time in your life to explore stuff, but you also have time on a day-to-day level that you don't necessarily have when you're older. And that time can be spent in many different ways. But to your point there, it's like explore avenues of thought or fun or, you know, creativity that you will never, like, be aware that that time won't last forever. That moment in your life won't last forever. So explore the most amount of possible scenarios that you can put yourself in. Like, just do things, like, even if it's a solitary pursuit, but it's something you care about and you achieve flow or whatever with, like, pursue it, because there's plenty of time to be doing other stuff that sort of, you know, life gets in the way. John Lennon quote that I probably would butcher, but there's plenty of time for that. Like, just recognize that. And also just take the pressure off yourself. Like, whenever I was 18, despite how I may have sort of conveyed that, like, I knew there was a drive in me to be successful and to start my business and to, you know, to go into the civil service and rise up the ranks. There was this ambient expectation on myself. But if I could go back to my own 18-year-old self, I'd just be like, man, just try stuff. You'll never know where it might lead you and you might not ever get the chance again. So relax and explore is probably my... yeah, double bit of advice.
I love it, man. Genuinely, really, really enjoyed this. It's been class. And big thanks again to NI Connections for sponsoring this series. Like we said at the top of the show, if you'd like to check out their newsletter or all the other interviews in this series, I think we're like over 30, including the Neville interview, actually, which we'll link in the show notes, Daniel, if you can make a wee note for that. NIConnections.com is the place to do it. And again, if you're thinking about moving back home, like Alan has, if you're long-time listener, zero time caller, zero time visitor to Northern Ireland, and you're like, you know what, this place sounds good. Sounds like a good place to start a business. The people sound great. Sounds like a good opportunity. You can head over to the website and find everything out there. Also, I'd like to give a thank you to Kieran May for hosting the Rising Tide event where Alan and I met. Really, really cool. So shout out to Kieran. And thanks to you, Daniel, for producing today's episode. And thank you very much for listening. Have a good one. Cheers, Alan.
Thank you.